Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. So here's the week that was: a new push on school assignments.
A dozen children probably attend a dozen different schools. Parents might not know each other. Students might not play together. We won't have the schools our kids deserve until we build school communities.
Renewed fury over proposed service cuts and fare hikes at the teeth.
It's very much a Sophie's choice. I mean, what's the worst of the two evils?
I'm not at all convinced that service reductions and fare increases are the only means to address the fiscal crisis.
And a Massachusetts Senate race now officially in full swing.
She talks about how she is a, quote, rock thrower. That sure doesn't sound like the kind of compromise and progress this country needs right now. Listen, I'm a bridge builder, not a rock thrower. Let me just tell you right there.
This is the standard Republican playbook right now. You know, it's the morning's talking points.
Well, we're going to get beyond the talking points right now with our Week in Review panel. Joining us is Jeff Jacoby, columnist for the Boston Globe. Hey there, Jeff.
Hey, Meghna.
And also with us is Ken Cooper, editor of the Trotter Review. Good to see you again, Ken.
Good to see you, Meghna.
All right. Well, let's start with that last little tit for tat you just heard. That was, of course, Senator Scott Brown announcing his reelection campaign last night in Worcester, and current Democratic frontrunner Elizabeth Warren reacting on a campaign stop not far from where Brown reannounced at Worcester's Mechanics Hall, I should say. So, Jeff, let's start with you. What do you make of the fact that Senator Brown even bothered to mention Elizabeth Warren, if not directly by name, in his reelection announcement?
I'm actually a little more surprised that he actually managed to mention the word Republican apparently twice in the entire speech.
Independent seemed to be the word of the day for him.
This is not going to be your, I guess we couldn't call it your father's Senate election, but this is certainly not going to be the 2010 Senate election. It's a very different environment in so many different ways. Scott Brown may have been able to surprise the political world by coming out of nowhere a year and a half ago. Everybody's waiting for him now. Democrats all over the country are very excited about the possibility of taking back what they see as, you know, their natural seat, Ted Kennedy's seat for so many decades. It's going to be a much, much longer race than that special election was. And whereas in 2010, a lot of, independents and even Democrats who weren't crazy about Barack Obama could sort of safely cast a protest vote against Obama this year, this time around, Obama's going to be on the ballot. Not only is that going to bring out hundreds of thousands of additional voters, but it is also going to bring out a lot of people who are very motivated to return Barack Obama to the White House. It's a much more steep uphill climb that Scott Brown's got this time around.
Ken, we're likely to see also the opposite, that many people who are motivated to not have the incumbent president return to the White House will probably also be going to the polls here in Massachusetts, which could affect the Senate race, of course.
Yeah, but that's true. But I think we guess that those who are motivated to reelect the president will outnumber those who are motivated to kick him out of office. I think much of what Jeff says is correct, and I think the biggest difference will be the broader electorate in this election than it was in the special election. And my own prediction is if Scott Brown is reelected, I'm not so sure he will be, it won't be because of the Tea Party. The Tea Party was effective in the special election because it was a narrow electorate, and we saw in the last round of congressional elections and statewide Senate races, the Tea Party has had much less effect than they did in the smaller House districts.
Well, let's talk about a thing that could have a big effect on this race, and that is money. I mean, according to some projections, there may be upwards of $60 million spent on this Senate race just here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And now, of course, more news this week where both Scott Brown challenged Elizabeth Warren to run a third-party attack ad-free campaign. Warren comes back and says, yes, let's put it in writing and make a legal agreement that would happen. Not sure what's going to come out of that legal agreement, but just a broader question, Jeff, is there any way that even informal agreement between the two to not run third-party attack ads would hold?
No.
I just can't see it.
No, the whole thing is ridiculous, and it's ridiculous on a few grounds. First of all, you can't run a modern political campaign, certainly not a modern U.S. Senate campaign, certainly not a modern U.S. Senate campaign in a state like Massachusetts without a ton of money being involved. And a lot more people are entitled and have an interest in wanting to affect this race than merely the two candidates that are running. There's a I think it's true. I may have read somewhere that Elizabeth Warren is a law professor. I think I saw that somewhere. If so, she's probably familiar with a thing called the First Amendment. The idea that somehow two people who are running for the U.S. Senate, planning on taking an oath of office to uphold the Constitution, are somehow going to try to put in place a system to prevent interested voters and interested Americans and interested parties from commenting on an election, the whole thing is ludicrous. Anyway, we've been through this. We've seen this movie before. Back in 96 when Bill Weld how quickly we forget, and John Kerry were facing each other.
The other senator.
They were facing each other in that year's Senate race, and at least in that case, the deal that they supposedly made was to limit their own spending.
To $5 million.
To $5 million each. I didn't remember the details, but the Globe, you know, recycled the story this past week and reminded me that Kerry basically broke it by dumping an extra something like $1.7 million in with, you know, 2 months to go. You can't try to keep the influence of money out of a modern campaign.
Well, Ken, let me ask you, I mean, about that. There's already a lot of money that's been spent on this race by third parties. The League of Women Voters posted $3 million worth of anti-Scott Brown ads. Crossroads GPS, a super PAC run by Karl Rove, has already spent $1 million on anti-Elizabeth Warren ads. So the money's being spent. It's probably going to be spent. But what I'm wondering is the fundraising power of both the Brown and Warren campaigns is pretty impressive as it is. I mean, just yesterday, Elizabeth Warren's campaign raised $1.17 million in one day. So does it even matter what the third parties do?
Well, it could, because the third parties tend to have less restraint than the candidates themselves. And if there's any impact on this agreement, and it doesn't have any legal force whatsoever, is to perhaps restrain some of the more extreme type of advertising that outside groups might do for fear of the backlash hurting their own candidate, given the climate they're trying to set. And I would add, Jeff, I mean, the agreement sort of goes against the spirit of the First Amendment, but the First Amendment actually restrains what government does about speech. And these are two private individuals who are not actually enforcing government power.
Mm. Understood. But nevertheless, you've got a race that so many people are interested in. The idea that you're somehow going to be able to even send a moral example or have the moral authority to get your supporters or the opponents of the candidate you're facing to somehow, you know, sit on their hands and not get involved, it just doesn't seem reasonable. And considering that we live in a society...
Why is it not reasonable, though?
We have no problem with spending billions of dollars to market and advertise and discuss the virtues of everything from soap to cars to, you know, to internet apps. Why should politics and the choosing of those who represent us be something that we attach less importance to?
Well, the money is coursing through the veins of this political season, so we'll see how that continues to develop. But if we can move on to another story of this week, and that is Boston Mayor Tom Menino. He gave his State of the City address this week. Many interesting things in his speech, but one proposal in particular regarding schools really caught people's attention, so let's listen.
Something stands in the way of taking our system to the next level. Our student assignment process that ships our kids to schools across our city. I'm committing tonight, 1 year from now, Boston will have adopted a radically different student assignment plan, one that puts a priority on children attending schools closer to their homes.
Okay, Ken, let's start off with you. So Mayor Tom Menino has revived the idea of giving an overhaul to the assignment plan to basically create neighborhood schools. I mean, it's something that people have tried and talked about before, but there are some downsides to this, too. First of all, your thought about the mayor's vague plan. It doesn't yet exist, but his desire to overhaul assignments.
Well, I think his assertion that the student assignment policy is actually keeping the schools from getting to a higher level is... I'd like to actually hear him explain what that means. I think before, and I'll concede that modifying the school assignment policy is widely popular with particularly middle-class families in Boston, and I would say particularly more so white families than minority families. But the problem is, and it's not transportation, the problem is inequitable school resources and inferior schools in some neighborhoods. I think Councilor Tito Jackson, mm-hmm. who represents Roxbury and Dorchester, talks about some incredible percentage of the city's failing schools are in his districts. You go to neighborhood schools, then his constituents are trapped in inferior schools, which, and I want to make this clear, everybody thinks busing was a product of a desire to desegregate and go to school, black kids send black kids to school with white kids. It all started in 1965, and the president of the Boston NAACP at that time said this recently, with a desire to get more resources into schools that taught black children, and that's still a problem today.
Well, just to buttress your point about the concerns that parents in some neighborhoods have, we have a little bit of tape from City Councilor Felix Arroyo making exactly this point, so let's listen.
I don't know what the mayor's going to propose and what it's going to lead to, but I hope that it goes down a path where it is, while at the same time giving parents the opportunity to send their child to a school in their community, it is not telling parents who don't have a good school in the community, that's it, them the cards, and that's where your kid's going
to
go.
So Jeff, I got to ask you, I mean, this seems to be a big challenge. On the one hand, to overhaul a system which has allowed kids to go to various schools around the city. On the other hand, how do you make a solution that doesn't maybe lead us to down the path towards basically what would effectively be a resegregation of Boston public schools?
Well, considering that you're talking about a school system in which 87% of the students are non-white, I'm not really sure what resegregation would even mean. Look, if this whole school assignment first of all, if Mania were a new mayor, if this were his first State of the City speech, or maybe his second, or maybe even his third, I could understand, you know, the hoopla being paid to this promise. This is not the first time he's made this promise. It's not the second time. It's not even the third time he's made this promise. At least as far back as 1999, he was talking about overhauling the system. Secondly, this isn't something that he thought up. You know, a light went on over his head. The Boston Globe, did a whole series of stories over the course of the past year following families in what was often excruciating detail. I mean, excruciating for what the families have to go through. The hopes and the dreams and the jumping through hoops, desperate to try to get their kids into a decent school. You know, I'm not an expert on this, but I'll tell you, as I read stories about public school education, especially in Boston, one thing that stands out to me over and over again is that the schools that parents most seem to want to get their kids into are the charter schools. And I don't understand, why doesn't the mayor stand up and say, you know what, we've tried all these things for the past 35 years. We've ended up with a system in which 87% of the kids aren't white. Huge numbers of parents aren't happy with the choices that are available to them. Let's throw open the doors and make every Boston public school a charter school.
Because
Ken, jump back in here.
Yeah, the reason he doesn't do that, and if he did, he'd be doing it without any evidence in the pedagogy. The best studies on the performance of charter schools show they do no better or somewhat worse than public schools,
but they
in general.
Give, but
the
they
more
give
you, the more you,
authority.
The more, the more, want. The more charter schools you have, the more they'll become like public schools. What you conceive of public schools as being.
There is a reason why whenever a charter school opens up, or whenever the lottery takes place to get kids into a charter school, parents are lined up around the block to get their kids in. They're so desperate to get out of the existing system. It's just inexcusable that the mayor stands up and talks about how, after all these years, he's finally going to come up with a plan to do something about it. No, he isn't, he's willing to burn some bridges, and he shows no signs.
Just because there's demand for it doesn't mean there's any educational justification for it. There is none.
Well, and if I may, the charter school sort of piece of this puzzle is an important one, but not one that obviously the mayor talked about yesterday. We've covered a lot, and we will continue to cover it. The overall point, though, I think is one that's an important one that's being made here, is that there is a desire of some kind amongst parents, whether it be to improve neighborhood schools such that their kids can actually go to a place they can walk to, or have massive change to the system overall. The thing is that the mayor hasn't said how he's going to do either of these things. We have to wait a year before the school
and
assignment plan comes
without,
out.
No dramatic change could take place without dramatically blowing up the existing bureaucracy. And the existing bureaucracy has a vested interest in basically keeping things the way they are. He shows no sign of being willing to go headlong, head first, smashing things that exist and upsetting people who have been his allies.
Well,
I just don't see it happening.
We're going to have to leave it at that for now because we're going to run out of time. But speaking of existing bureaucracies, there is one more bureaucracy I want to just talk about briefly, and that is the MBTA. Obviously, this week they've started their 20 or so public hearings where people have a chance to have a say about the proposed rate hikes and service cuts. Just in a minute or two, what do you make of? There's been strong response so far. People just don't like the idea, especially of those service cuts. Ken, your response?
Yeah, I'd like to put out an idea for the MBTA that may not have come up in public. At least I'm not sure it has. I would like to see the MBTA set its fare structure the way the Washington Metro does. The longer you ride, the more you pay. As it stands now, everybody pays the same thing. The transit dependent, who takes short rides, say from Roxbury, Dorchester to downtown, pay as much as the suburbanites who travel 3, 4, 5 times the distance.
So you want a zone system, type of zone system.
It depends on how far you ride.
Okay.
It seems to me the biggest problem is that you've got a system in which the T loses money on every passenger that it carries. It's been the case for years that the fares are not high enough to cover even the services that they provide, never mind the services that people want. I've been living in Boston for 30 years, and as long as I've been here, the T has been a mess. The Globe won one of its first Pulitzer Prizes documenting the horrific culture that existed at the T. I was talking to one of my colleagues who said it's like Greece, way over its head in debt, promises that can't possibly be fulfilled, expectations that are much too high, and a current budget deficit that's drowning the whole system in red ink.
Well, it should be noted that part of that debt was put on the shoulders of the T by the state itself due to the big dig. So maybe the state has some role to play in its long-term solution for financing the T. I will leave it at that. So now, gentlemen, if we can, as we do close our Week in Review segments, as always, with our hubbub, and that's the stories that didn't maybe make it above the fold. And Anthony, we'll start with you.
Yeah, well, so my hubbub is about, we all know there's a big Patriots game tomorrow. And earlier this week, we were talking with Bill Littlefield about whether the almost Super Bowl-bound Patriots are now the city's and the region's favorite team, overtaking the Red Sox in that department. And we invited our listeners to cast their vote for their favorite team. And Meghna, gentlemen, and I use that term loosely, we have the results here. Okay, so it's Patriots, Red Sox, Bruins, Celtics, and the Revolution. And literally the overwhelming response we got from literally dozens of listeners.
We have more listeners than that.
One vote for the Boston Celtics coming in last place. Five votes for the Bruins and five votes for the Revolution. Six votes for the Red Sox on top. 10 votes for the Patriots. But here's the thing that's really troubling to me. 45 votes, or 62.5% of those cast, checked other. So I'm not sure.
But do you know who other is?
Well, this is the thing. The Lobster.
The Boston Lobsters.
The Boston Lobsters. Well, I got to say something about
this
vote.
Jeff, you're giving me a knowing look? No.
This.
If it involves sports, I'm not giving you a knowing
that's
look.
That's why I called you.
Maybe
out
an
on
unknowing
it.
Look.
I have some evidence that a couple of people have cast ballots more than once. I won't name her, although she is my co-host. So anyway, like the Iowa caucuses, I'm not sure if this result is definitive or if it actually means anything. So,
and just in case there are any Lobster fans listening, we do know that there's world team tennis. Apparently there's team tennis. There's a world league.
That's right. I've seen it.
All right, Ken, your hubbub.
Yes, I'd like to invoke a couple of images from this holiday week. The first is from the Boston Globe. It's of a young Martin Luther King Jr., then a divinity student at Boston University, playing basketball in his street shoes. Apparently he did not even own a pair of sneakers, but he liked to play basketball. And the second is from the Bay State Banner, and it's a photograph of a young Hassan Sharif, who's a friend of mine and is now a retired social worker, in 1965, holding an umbrella over Dr. King's head at a demonstration he had over inequitable school resources here in Boston in 1965.
It's a nice hubbub. I mean, we heard this week also, actually, Anthony, you did a great piece about the effect that Dr. King's time at BU had on his sort of theology and philosophy as
That's
well.
That's right. Yeah.
So really great hubbub. Jeff, on to you.
Well, as you know, I know nothing about sports, but with all this talk in the air about Baltimore and Ravens and whatnot, I thought that I would mention that the other night in Baltimore at the Westminster Hall burial ground, there were people who waited up past a midnight dreary, hoping that the mysterious person known as the Poe Toaster would make an appearance. This is somebody who, or somebody's, nobody's quite sure, who's going back at least 40 years, showed up every year on the anniversary of Edgar Allan Poe's birthday to lay a half a bottle of French cognac and three roses at his grave. He didn't show up 2 years ago, didn't show up last year. The decision was somehow made if the Poe Toaster doesn't show up this year, it probably means he's going to show up nevermore.
I was gonna
and sad to say, if they're right, the Poe Toaster is nevermore. I don't know, if that's an omen for Sunday,
for the game,
Baltimore.
Maybe?
I have no idea, but Poe Toaster, nevermore.
Well, our resident sports expert, Jeff Jacoby, on the crystal ball and what it says about Sunday's game. Well, I'm going to wrap up with a shout-out to Worcester, since we started there with our discussion on politics. Apparently today, a website known as CareerBliss.com, it's an online career website, has found that Worcester is the second happiest place to work in the country.
After WBUR.
Yes, but no, apparently it's Miami. If WBUR moved to Miami, that would be true. More than 40,000 workers they polled. Worcester came in second. The unhappiest place to work in the country, New Haven, Connecticut. I don't know why.
And they surveyed how many cities? Four?
I don't know where Boston falls on that list, but apparently the average salary of in Worcester is $53,000, in New Haven it's $62,000, so they're challenging whether or not there's any correlation between income and employee happiness. So good job, Worcester. That's it for today's hubbub and today's Week in Review. Jeff Jacoby, columnist for the Boston Globe, great to have you as always.
Good job, Meghna.
And Ken Cooper, editor of the Trotter Review. Thanks as well.
Thanks.
Well, up next, one key to improving the region's economy is access to affordable housing, but budget cuts at the federal level are making it even harder to get this kind of housing built. We'll find out why. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.